Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman. Some doubts are being expressed about Russia's complete commitment to a Syrian ceasefire. Top U.S. intelligence officials are raising concerns that Russia may not be completely committed to a peaceful resolution of the conflict in Syria. The Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, told lawmakers Thursday that Russia is preoccupied with its involvement in Syria and could soon take additional steps to bolster the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. During testimony before a House committee on intelligence, Clapper said they're confronting the possibility, I think, or considering whether they're going to put more ground forces in. Intelligence officials say there has been a constant but incremental expansion of the Russian footprint in Syria, but caution that they have not seen indications of any major uptick in Russian operations ahead of the midnight Saturday deadline for the cessation of hostilities to go into effect. Greece's foreign ministry says it is recalling its ambassador to Austria back to Athens for consultations, a day after Austria held a meeting with officials from Balkan countries to discuss how to limit the numbers of migrants flowing into Europe, but did not invite Greece. Foreign Minister Nikos Kotsias recalled the ambassador Thursday in order to safeguard what he called the friendly relations between the states and the people of Greece and Austria. Greece's massive maritime border with Turkey and the close proximity of its islands to the Turkish coast have made it the main point of entry for hundreds of thousands of people fleeing war and poverty at home and hoping for better lives in Europe. The ministry said it was clear that the big problems of the European Union cannot be dealt with thoughts, mentalities, and extra-institutional initiatives that have their roots in the 19th century. VOA News. NATO allies have agreed on a plan for their ships in the Aegean Sea to help Turkey and Greece counter criminal networks smuggling refugees into Europe. NATO sent ships to the Aegean last week to help Turkey and Greece stop criminal networks smuggling migrants. Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the modalities had been agreed for its action in the Aegean Sea.
Our commanders will decide the area where they will be operating in coordination with Greece and Turkey. NATO vessels can deploy in the territorial waters of Greece and Turkey. Greek and Turkish forces will not operate in each other's territorial waters and airspace. If Allied vessels encounter people in distress at sea, they have to live up to their national responsibilities to assist.
Relations between Greece and Turkey have traditionally been tense, and since the February 11th deal by NATO defense ministers to deploy ships to the Aegean, Greece's defense minister has accused Turkey of trying to undermine the deal. A Somali official says a mortar attack targeting the Somali presidential palace has killed 3 civilians, including a child. Police Captain Mohammed Hussein said Thursday the mortars hit a residential area of the capital of Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab, the militant group, an Al-Qaeda affiliate, claimed responsibility for the attack. Al-Shabaab wants to overthrow Somalia's weak UN-backed government and govern Somalia under a harsh interpretation of Islamic law. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon met with South Sudan's president Thursday in an effort to advance the peace accord aimed at ending that country's civil war. Ban's visit to Juba came as the South Sudanese government and opposition prepare to form a unity government in which rebel chief Riek Machar will serve as first vice president. Speaking to reporters after the meeting, South Sudan's foreign minister said Kiir assured the secretary general of his commitment to implement the accord. The Palestinians are criticizing the Kenyan president's visit to the region, saying his stops at East Jerusalem and the West Bank are akin to accepting Israel's occupation. During his first official visit to Israel this week, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta met with Kenyan students in a West Bank settlement and visited the Western Wall, a Jewish holy site in East Jerusalem. The Palestinians want the West Bank and East Jerusalem captured by Israel in 1967 as part of their hoped-for state. The Palestinians are also upset Kenyatta has not visited any Palestinian city. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhiban coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
And earlier on today, they have a different leader. They met civil society organizations, they met the opposition leaders in the country, they also met religious leaders in order to see and examine the current situation and how the current situation is on the ground and what exactly and what we should do in order to bring a stop on the ongoing violence.
That's reporter Moses Havyarimana on the visit of five heads of states to Burundi to help encourage peace talks between the government and the opposition. Details coming up.
Also, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon travels to Juba, South Sudan, today to meet with President Salva Kiir. And the UN says it has found widespread atrocities committed with impunity by a variety of armed groups in Libya.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily feature. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon travels to Juba, South Sudan today to meet with President Salva Kiir and visit a UN shelter for civilians affected by the conflict. Ban's visit comes as opposing groups in the South Sudan peace process prepare to form a unity government mandated by the peace agreement they signed in August. South Sudan's Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission on Tuesday announced an agreement to allow 1,370 opposition forces into the capital in preparation for rebel leader Riek Machar to join a transitional government. More security forces are expected to join them after the power-sharing transitional government is formed. After 2 years of civil war, rebel leader Machar and South Sudan President Salva Kiir signed a peace deal in August. They pledged to run a unity government for 30 months before holding elections. Kiir appointed Machar as his vice president last week in the first step toward forming the unity government. Despite the moves toward solidarity, fighting does continue in parts of South Sudan.
The French press agency reports that five heads of state have arrived in Burundi. They've been sent by the African Union to help push for talks between Burundi's government and opposition. The delegation, which will visit for 2 days, includes the leaders of South Africa, Ethiopia, Gabon, and Mauritania. The visit comes on the heels of a trip to the country by the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on Tuesday. Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza told him that he would begin an inclusive dialogue with the opposition. Moses Havyarimana is in the Burundian capital. VOA's David Arnold asked him for details.
African president come into Bujumbura since yesterday and later today, led by the South African president, Jacob Zuma, came to ask the Burundian government and other political stakeholders to go for an inclusive dialogue in order to put an end to the ongoing violence that has rocked the country.
And since they arrived yesterday, has there been any publicity about their achievements?
Yes, exactly. Later on today in the evening, it should be the last meeting, actually, with President Pierre Nkurunziza. Later on, and earlier on today, the five African leaders met civil society organizations, they met the opposition leaders in the country, they also met religious leaders in order to see and examine the current situation and how the current situation is on the ground and what exactly and what we should do in order to bring a stop on the ongoing violence. But today we expect the German leader to visit the president in order to have some talks on ongoing situation and in order to discuss the current situation. Possibly this could be urging the government for the inclusive dialogue.
Is the government willing to go ahead with inclusive dialogue?
Yes, it has been a major question on what exactly the inclusive dialogue is, because the international community, the African Union, have urged the government to go for the inclusive dialogue. However, the government have said that they will not go into dialogue with some specific political stakeholders, whom it said that they were peaceful stakeholders. These are some of the oppositions who fled the country, and these are the real actors and the cause of the current political crisis in the country.
Is there any indication that the five heads of state insist that all parties be involved in the dialogue?
Yeah, this is one of the major issues that's going to be tackled by the president, of course, because otherwise, if the Burundi government says that it's from the dialogue commission, yes, it is from the dialogue commission and that they've conducted dialogue in the countryside. However, some opposition leaders felt like this is not where the problem is. The problem is where with the political actors who have fled the country, and those some army officials who defected have to be brought on board and to discuss the main social issues and to end the violence which has rocked the country. And these are the main people who have been contributing to the ongoing political crisis in the country. If nothing is being done to bring them and to stop this current political crisis, one of the opposition leaders I was talking to yesterday, he told me that these all political leaders should be brought on board, regardless of what they did in the past. All they have to do is just to bring an end to the ongoing violence in the country.
There is an indication by the very presence of these five heads of state that there's some urgency to settle the country and at least significantly reduce the violence. But the violence seems to continue. According to Human Rights Watch, they're saying that many of the abuses are being concealed when the military tortures and arbitrarily arrests scores of people. What's the that's the accusation from Human Rights Watch. What is the government's response?
The government has always been saying that the human rights reports are not true, and they were always saying that the human rights have been not giving the actual figures, they've been not giving the actual reports of what is going on the ground. However, this new human rights report that came out after the authorities saying that it was targeting some opponents with increased brutality and the government forces are killing and abducting, torturing or arbitrarily arresting the scores of the people at the alarming rate. We have been seeing the report going on and on. And however, the Burundian government have also been continually denying on these allegations that there could be violating the human rights or torturing. So what is saying, the Burundian government is saying that it is always trying to make sure the peace and stability is restored in the capital. However, what we see right now in the capital, sometimes we see the grenade attacks with the in some specific areas, in public overcrowded public areas where the grenade attacks are being conducted. So this is a major problem with the current security forces, because they can't know exactly who is conducting this, and no one has come yet to claim these attacks.
That was reporter Moses Habyarimana from Bujumbura. He was speaking with VOA's David Arnold.
A United Nations investigating team has found what it says are widespread atrocities committed with impunity by a variety of armed groups in Libya. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report by the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva.
A six-member UN team says it gathered a wealth of information and evidence of gross violations of human rights in Libya from hundreds of victims and witnesses. The investigators allege armed groups allied with Libya's two competing governments, multiple independent groups, and Islamic State militants are guilty of wide-ranging abuses, many of which could amount to war crimes. The report describes unlawful killings, including executions of people taken captive. It documents indiscriminate attacks on health facilities, ambulances, and medical workers. It says the use of torture, arbitrary detention, abductions, and disappearances are widespread. Other issues of concern include violence and discrimination against women, intimidation of human rights defenders and journalists, recruitment of children, and exploitation of vulnerable migrants. Gurdip Sangha, a desk officer with the UN agency, says the report goes into detail about what is happening to the people in Libya.
You'll see in very stark terms the actual accounts of victims and witnesses, of people who have had a bag put over their head when they're leaving their home, being abducted and being assaulted and tortured and dumped back, of migrants who have been subjected to horrific abuse.
Sangha says these abuses and crimes flourish in an environment of complete impunity. He says the justice system in Libya is broken, with judges and prosecutors often abducted and killed, while courts are subject to bomb attacks.
Some of these attacks have been linked to the detention or the release of individuals, or to thwart the arrest or prosecution of members. And ultimately, that's working. There have been no prosecutions of armed brigade, armed group leaders, and there have been very limited investigations of any armed group leaders or armed group members.
The report recommends urgent action to stop the proliferation of armed groups in Libya. It says individuals who are responsible for human rights violations and abuses should not be recruited into any armed force. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In October, Sierra Leone created its first classes for pregnant girls in an attempt to deal with the rise in sexual violence and teenage pregnancies. Prior to that, if a girl was pregnant, she was not allowed to go to school at all. Nina De Vries looks at the progress the program has made.
Seventeen-year-old Elizabeth Issa is just one of thousands of young girls across the country taking alternative classes. She has a seven-month-old daughter who is watched by her parents when she's in school. She says she prefers this kind of classroom setting. Often shame is brought on girls who get pregnant while still in school, she explains in her native Creole dialect.
You tell me how you get me belly. I know me nobody's.
She says that when she was pregnant, she felt a bit embarrassed and stayed inside her house. But she says she feels better in school with girls sharing the same experience. The alternative schools have been successful, according to Olive Musa, the head of non-formal education at the Ministry of Education, Science and Technology. She says an estimated 11,000 girls have registered for the schools. Originally, the classes were only for those who got pregnant during the Ebola crisis, but others were so eager to do it, they've been granted access. But not everyone is on board with the concept. Human rights group Amnesty International says even though there are alternative classes, students are still not allowed to take exams to get into senior secondary school or college if they're visibly pregnant, and there are no alternative options for that. In an email to VOA, West African Amnesty researcher Sabrina Matani said the government must act to protect girls' right to non-discrimination and education, and this means protecting their right to continue on in mainstream schools and sit exams equally with others should they wish to do so. Matani also said the school's alternative curriculum must be monitored to determine the quality of education. Currently, classes are held just 3 times a week for a couple of hours. But Musa says the attitudes cannot change overnight.
I don't think it's morally right. And considering the culture we have, we are yet to reach that point for accepting that if you are visibly pregnant, you have to take exams with those that are not pregnant. Of course, in the colleges, in the university, nobody cares. But at that tender age, people want to frown on it.
She adds the government is looking at methods to ensure student pregnancies are reduced.
That's why we have to intensify the family planning, the sexual reproductive health programs, so that at least we teach them about prevention.
For now, the only option is the alternative classes. Elizabeth Issa, who wants to be a banker, says she feels she's learning enough, but admit some of her peers wanted to attend mainstream schools, even while pregnant. Nina De Vries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America with Yehias Wuhib and Kim Lewis in Washington. A new online dictionary aims to catalog and define all the common names used by people of West Africa's Yoruba ethnic group. The dictionary's founders say they hope it will preserve Yoruba culture and language. Chris Stein reports from Lagos.
The Yoruba people are one of Nigeria's largest ethnic groups. Their language is spoken mostly in Nigeria's southwest and in parts of neighboring Benin and Togo. Like many African cultures, Yorubas give their newborns names with meanings. But linguist Kola Tuboshin says understanding the naming tradition is dying out among the Yorubas.
There exist people here, and you will find many of them on the streets, who bear names and they don't know what they mean.
Tuboshin founded YorubaName.com, an online dictionary that was launched earlier this month. Dadepo Adaremi is the site's lead developer.
The whole idea is to provide a central place where people can find all, hopefully all of the Yoruba names and be able to find its meaning.
While millions of Nigerians call Yoruba their mother tongue, Tuboshin says the language is under threat.
Over time, parents have bought into this idea that if you don't learn English or learn in English, then you are deny yourself a chance for a good future filled with opportunities. So they encourage their children to speak only in English.
He hopes the dictionary plays a role in reversing that trend.
I realize that something is going to get lost over time if we don't find a way to document these things.
Tuboshin hopes to add more names to the site and eventually start dictionaries for other languages in Nigeria and elsewhere in Africa. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Last Tuesday, the Republic of Liberia and the United Nations International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD, announced their agreement to finance two programs to help the country's 35,000 cocoa farmers. The program was also designed to generate sorely needed foreign exchange. And Dayubel Tichiku is IFAD's country program manager. She told VOA's Adam Phillips that the so-called tree crops extension project is designed to boost the Liberian economy, whose recovery from civil war was slowed by the recent Ebola crisis.
The tree crop sector has always been an important crop for Liberia. And as some of you might know, during the war, all those families and farmers were totally displaced. And so after the war, the government decided that the tree crop sector was a priority and we started looking for investment. If we look at the international market, cocoa is one of the few cash crop with positive trend for the near future. So it's a good investment to bring about much needed foreign exchange for the country, as well as income in the pockets of smallholder farmers. And so IFAD was a partner in that, and that's when we started engaging in 2009 and now in 2016. And we firmly believe, and that's also the opinion of the government of Liberia, that the farmers, to have a voice, they need to be organized. By being organized, they increase their way to bargain or discuss with the private operator. This is one way we can work with the farmer for them to get a better price.
I understand the Civil War was over, and then all of a sudden Ebola became a huge issue. I'm wondering what the connection is between the Ebola crisis and the recovery from the war.
After the war, Liberia was very much on its way to have very strong growth. Unfortunately, Ebola struck, and most of the gains were actually wiped out.
Ebola was a horrible crisis, of course, but relatively few people in the Liberian population were actually infected with the virus. Why did it have such a profound effect on the cocoa tree farms and the economy?
Ebola is a highly contagious disease. So the country had to have some strict measures of containment, some of which included market closure, the prevention of group labor, as well as some quarantines. And therefore, many farmers could not sell their products. Some of them could not work on their farms, which led to many farms being abandoned and many farms not being able to sell their products. This has contributed to bring more poverty into the rural areas. In addition, of course, to families directly losing family members due to the Ebola virus.
And so IFAD is making loans to these farmers as a way to help them out?
I need to clarify that the loans are not provided to the farmer. IFAD's investments are agreements between IFAD and the government of Liberia. With those funds, the government of Liberia is hiring staff to actually implement the project that is being designed.
I know the private sector is going to be involved too, so this is obviously an international trade issue.
Yes, the private sector will also be a partner, so they can buy the cocoa, they can work with the farmers to let them know what are the standards in international markets and what would be the quantity would be required. We are talking about investing in a value chain approach. So currently, many of those farmers are not investing or spending a lot of time on the cocoa farm because it doesn't produce much. Let's say that on harvesting, they can have about 100 kilos per hectare. And it's not because the farm doesn't produce more, is that it's only what they would harvest from the farm. What we are proposing is that the farmer will spend more time on the farm so that with improved farming methods or farming habits, they would now harvest anywhere between 400 to 600 or 700 kilos per hectare without substantial use of fertilizers.
Tell me, how does infrastructure fit into the program, and why does that relate to the project of getting these farmers back on track?
So picture yourself in a country with lush, luxuriant vegetation, with no roads. So you have people carrying bags of cocoa on their heads from their farms to the market. By doing so, they can probably carry maybe one bag or two bags a day, because it takes anywhere between half an hour to 3 to 4 hours from the farm to the market. And EFAD would actually provide investments to build feeder roads between a number of farms and markets as well as cooperatives.
And the money is supposed to go to the government, and the government uses the money to train people?
It's not that the government is using the money to train people, it's to implement the project. And the implementation includes many things, right? The building of roads requires the hiring of contractor to actually build those roads, so it will create employment. Number two, you know, we need to hire local staff to implement the project, so it requires to pay the salaries. Number three, we talked about working with cooperatives. Those cooperatives need to be strengthened. For that strengthening, we need to call for the required expertise. Some of it, it's local, other it's regional, and other will be international. So all of that requires some resources. Number four, we're talking about improved planting material. It has to come from somewhere. So it's also part of the way the money will be invested. We're talking about tracking farms. Some technology will need to be used, GPS technologies. Tools need to be purchased. People need to be trained. So that's where the money will be going.
That was Ndai Yobel Tichiku, the country program manager for the Tree Crop Extension Project. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips from her office in Rome, Italy. This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next on Let's Talk. School uniforms. Do you support a school dress code? Join hosts Sande Shomari and his guests discussing school uniforms. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa. Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We'll discuss the beauty of Africa with me, Esther Gidoy-Ewart, as guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is our moment. We are speaking out to end malaria.
This is DJ Drogba. Malaria is preventable and treatable.
Sleep under an insecticide-treated mosquito net every night. Go to a health center at the first sign of fever for testing and appropriate treatment.
Join me. United, we can beat malaria.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon travels to Juba, South Sudan today to meet with President Salva Kiir. And five African heads of state arrive in Burundi to encourage peace negotiations between the government and opposition. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa. And in our feature segment, Kenyans getting loans at reduced rates via their mobile phones and Facebook. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhid, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand there's a big football election on Friday.
Kim, joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports to talk about that big election is our football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Sunny.
David, on Friday in Zurich, Switzerland, world football's governing body, FIFA, will elect a new president. What are the latest developments?
Well, Sonny, there are still five in the race. The favorite with the bookmakers at 4-7. He's got a rather long name. It's Sheikh Salman bin Ibrahim Al Khalifa. He's from Bahrain. He is the big boss of Asian football, and he seems to be the man that certainly the bookmakers believe is going to succeed Sepp Blatter as president of FIFA. The man seen as the strongest challenger to him is Gianni Infantino. Now, that's an Italian-sounding name, but in fact, Infantino comes from Switzerland. In fact, Sonny, a little bit of research for the Voice of America discovered that he comes from a town very close to where Sepp Blatter was born. There in the,
interesting.
In the western, yes, very interesting, in the western corner of Switzerland. He is 7-4, so he is the second favorite. The other three contenders, Sonny, and I just don't hold out too much hope for them, are a former FIFA official, Jerome Champagne of France. You've got the Jordanian prince, Ali bin Al Hussein. Now, here I think we need to explain something, and that is people are saying, but he did very well in the last elections against Blatter. He got a lot of votes. He actually took Blatter to a second round before withdrawing. But there's a big difference, Sonny. The last time, it was just the prince against Sepp Blatter. And what the prince got was a lot of votes from Europe. And as far as I'm concerned, as much as they were votes for the prince, they were votes against Sepp Blatter. Now, this time, Infantino is expected to get those European votes. And for that reason only, I believe the prince is not going to be the next president of FIFA. And then you've got the lone African challenger, Tokyo Sekwale. Now, very recently, World Soccer, I've been reading that since I was 4 years old. That's 50 years ago. they pointed out, Sonny, that just as the elections loom, they gave the website for each of the challengers, except for Tokyo Sekwale. I was absolutely stunned to see website under construction. And that, to me, sums up the whole Tokyo Sekwale campaign. Totally underwhelming. He's been strongly criticized within Africa. I mean, the president of the Ghanaian Football Association lashed out at him and said, no ways in this whole wide world was he going to support Sekwale. And to me, Sonny, for Sekwale to have any chance of success, he had to have the backing of the Confederation of African Football. But instead of backing Sekwale, Issa Hayatou, the president, and his executive have decided to back the Sheikh Salman, the president of Asia. Strange things happen, Sonny, sometimes in football and in life. But right now, I would say Tokyo Sekwale is probably a million to one shot. I just don't see it happening. And I don't know why he hasn't withdrawn, because as I see it, he's facing humiliation in Zurich on Friday. I think this contest is very quickly going to boil down to the Sheikh against Infantino. And Africa and North and Central America may well be the playmakers in this situation. North and Central America, they've got 35 votes, and that could sway it one way or the other. But the really interesting one for me is Africa. No sooner had CAF said they were backing the Sheikh than Musa Bility, the Liberian FA president, who initially was in contention for the presidential race, but he was kicked out over some technicalities. He said that he knew of at least half the 54 African votes would not go to the Sheikh, they would go to others. But that is not automatically good news for Infantino, because Egypt, for example, and Liberia itself, they said they're going with Prince Ali. And Champagne has been endorsed by no less a person than the 1995 World, European, and African Footballer of the Year, George Weah.
Hello, I'm George Weah.
So what you could have, Sonny, is you could have maybe 25, 26 votes not going to the Sheikh. But if they're split up among the other contenders, then that will greatly weaken the chances of Infantino. For Infantino to beat the Sheikh, I believe he's got to get maybe 20 of those African votes. But it's a really fascinating election and reminds me a lot of 1998 when Lennart Johansson, the UEFA president who came from Sweden, was the hot favorite. He was up against Sepp Blatter, who was then the Secretary General of FIFA. And lo and behold, Blatter won it on the first round, an astounding victory, one that really shook the rafters of the FIFA headquarters. And of course, as we all know, Blatter went on to become a very long-serving president of FIFA. And whatever you say about Sepp Blatter, he was extremely popular in Africa. And the reason for that, Sonny, is he delivered. He gave the Africans those annual grants, which really were the difference between survival and going under as far as a lot of the national football associations were concerned. And then, absolutely crucial, he said he would bring the World Cup to Africa. There were a lot of doubters, but in 2010, lo and behold, South Africa held what was generally considered to be a very successful World Cup. Ironically, Sonny, the one thing that didn't really work is the last thing you would have expected to be a problem in Africa, and that was the weather. South Africa in winter, which is June and July, gets extremely cold after dusk. And there just wasn't that vibe after the night matches that you had in, for example, in 2006 in Germany. It was too cold for people to congregate around stadiums, and the fan parks didn't really work. And quite a surprise that the cold weather sort of undermined just a little bit a World Cup in Africa. And needless to say, Sonny, although he's now very much on the sidelines, if Blatter was running in this election, I would confidently predict to our Voice of America listeners that Africa would back Sepp Blatter. But now it's in the melting pot. The only thing I'm pretty sure of is I don't believe the Sheikh is going to get all 54 African votes. So, Sonny, to summarize, it looks like it's between the Sheikh and Infantino. They're the two, and we'll know on Friday in Zurich which one of them takes over a job, Sonny, that I don't think either is can be particularly looking forward to. Huge challenges ahead. I mean, FIFA really has been dragged through the mud. There's an awful lot of work to be done. If they can do it successfully, then they're going to be absolute heroes. But it's a mighty task. I've got a suspicion, Sonny, they might even call in you and me for some assistance.
We'll lend a hand, David. I know we can help them out.
For a Swiss franc, Sonny, we can do a lot.
David, this might amuse you and our VOA listeners. I received a handwritten letter from Chiji Ogwurike in Owerri, Imo State, Nigeria. And Chiji says, I should go and contest for the FIFA presidency on Friday in Zurich. At this point, Chiji, I think I'd have to be a write-in candidate, but I appreciate your support. And I think I'll heed the words of my friend and VOA producer this evening, Bill Werkinger. Stay in your lane. So I'm going to stay in my sporty lane right here in Washington, Chiji. Chiji adds that he's been listening to the Voice of America since 1979, and he loves all VOA programs, especially the Sunny Side of Sports.
What's better than the Sunny Side of Sports? More Sunny Side of Sports. Listen to our new expanded show now on VOA Africa.
It's time to climb between the ropes once again with our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moueta. Good evening, Nnamdi.
And a good evening, Sonny.
Filipino boxing star Manny Pacquiao in the news lately, Nnamdi, not for his boxing skills, but for some very controversial remarks he made about gays. And it seems like it's coming back to hurt him in a lot of ways. Nike withdraws sponsorship from Pac-Man. What are the latest developments over those remarks, Nnamdi?
It's been a public relations nightmare, not for only the Nike situation, but Top Rank and Bob Arum, his promoters. They're really concerned because it's going to affect the gates, and not only that, it will affect the pay-per-view. Many in the past made commercials for Nike. He's been on Nike's payroll for more than 6 years. When you're paid to endorse a company, you have responsibility. Last year alone, he made $12 million from endorsement.
Wow. And how much of that was Nike-related, Namdi?
Big chunk from Nike. So it's a situation where we in the game, we don't understand, because don't expect Nike emblem for this fight coming up with Timothy Bradley.
Manny Pacquiao scheduled to fight Timothy Bradley for a third time on April 9th in Las Vegas. How has this controversy affected this rubber match, Namdi?
This is unnecessary spotlight for this fight, because for the press conference, this question of LGBT will always come up. He made $150 million with Floyd Mayweather last year. Part of the LGBT community contributed to this $150 million. We are in a situation now where we don't know what will happen come April 9th, because there may be a huge boycott, because this community is a very strong community, Sonny. And this community will not just sit idle and watch this man say things and get away with it.
Manny Pacquiao typically trains at the Wild Card Gym in Hollywood, your backyard, Namdi, under the tutelage of Freddie Roach. What's the latest on his training for Bradley?
They opened camp in the Philippines, and it's not been going well. He has a lot on his plate for this, because the election is coming up in May. He has this situation of this LGBT comment that he made. Even the worst part about it was the comment he made after posting biblical scriptures saying homosexuals should be put to death. That was after he made his first comment. That was the second time around, was just damaging.
Namdi, any chance this fight could be canceled because of the controversy?
Well, good question, Sonny. His political opponent in the Philippines has called for the cancellation of this fight or postponement of this fight, because the election in the Philippines is to happen in May. So they're talking about, well, this is not going to be an even playing field, because when he fights, Manny Pacquiao fights in the U.S., the whole country will be watching. So they're dealing with Fair Election Act, equal access to it by everybody. So they've called for the postponement or cancellation of the fight. But this fight is not happening in Manila. This fight is in Las Vegas. Some people in the game felt that he had to make statements like this to sell tickets. We are in an age now, Sonny, where politicians just say stupid, dumb stuff to get votes. You know, here in America, we're dealing with a big, huge Donald Trump. And he's winning. He's winning big, you know. Elections coming up in the Philippines, and he's saying outrageous things to get votes. But look at his career, the damage this will do to his career. And that, because a lot of people will be rooting for him to get knocked out come April 9th in Las Vegas.
Namdi, you talk about selling tickets. Also on April 9th, Charles Martin, the IBF heavyweight champion, goes up against one of your favorite heavyweights, Anthony Joshua, with ties to Nigeria. Getting to the tickets, Namdi, how can the Martin-Joshua bout affect ticket sales for Bradley Pacquiao?
Oh, Sonny, that fight will affect Bradley Pacquiao. If I have my way, Sonny, this fight was announced late. I already booked my room at the MGM Grand Casino. So I'd rather be at the O2 Arena watching Anthony destroy Charles Martin than sitting ringside at the MGM Grand Casino watching two guys run around. You know? The real fight is the fight coming on Showtime from O2 Arena in London. AJ against Charles Martin, which would be a big fight for homeboy. And he stands a very good chance of scoring an explosive knockout and taking the belt.
Martin from the United States. Why is he going to the British capital, Namdi, to take on Anthony Joshua?
Sonny, the fight game is about money. In his last fight, when he picked up the title right here in the U.S. at the Barclay Arena in New York City, he made $250,000, Sonny. Going to London, he's going to make $3 million.
Wow, what an increase.
Well, that's what we call in the fight game. It's a cash out. The promoter takes, because he didn't look that great when he picked up the belt in New York. He looked ordinary, you know. So and he only made 250. There's no way he can even make $3 million in the next 2 years. So why don't you just go up to London, pick up your $3 million, and then hey, just say goodbye.
Namdi, we'll say goodbye for now, but I know you'll be back soon on the Sunny Side of Sports, firing your verbal jabs. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moweta. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. And check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. VOA intern Rick Narcisse is guest blogger on the latest post dealing with Denver Nuggets rookie point guard Emmanuel Mudiay, who is from the Democratic Republic of Congo. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yehias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Kenyans getting loans to reduce rates via their mobile phones and Facebook. But for some music, here is South Africa's Yvonne Chaka Chaka with Bombani.
Brasil, pra baixo, pra cima, 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 pra baixo, pra cima
South Africa's Yvonne Chaka Chaka with Bombani.
In Kenya, interest rates on business loans can go as high as 26%. But an American techpreneur has now developed an app through which Kenyans can get loans at reduced rates via their mobile phones and Facebook. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
Samuel Kinuthia, a chef in Nairobi, begins his workday by preparing ingredients for the day's special. He has been a chef for the last 18 years and started his own catering business last year to supplement his regular income. Kinuthia got a loan to start his business through Branch, a microlender that provides financial services including loans to Kenya residents. He says Branch has been a boon for his business.
A catering is quite expensive and I've been trying to acquire a few items here and there, but Branch has been with me all along the way. And it's also less of a hassle because at 8 to 9% interest on a 42-day loan is quite easy to maintain and quite friendly. And then the repayment plan, you can pay in small amounts even before the scheduled payment dates.
Introduced in 2015 by Matt Flannery, Branch is a microfinance institution that has been billed as a bank in your pocket. The app can be accessed on Google Play Store and on Facebook. For a six-month repayment period, clients can apply for loans from as little as $10 to a maximum of $500, and the interest rates are as low as 5% in a country where banks charge as much as 26%. There are three other major companies targeting the microloan market: Mshwari, Mco-op Cash, and KCB M-Pesa, all of them linked to large commercial banks.
We don't necessarily see ourselves as directly competing with them. We don't think this is a winner-takes-all market. We're very excited to be working alongside them, and I think we're all working towards the same kind of goal here.
And for Samuel Kinuthia, that goal is using advancements in technology to make it easier to expand his business. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Citizens of the Democratic Republic of Congo, or the DRC, should go to the polls in November to vote in a new president and members of parliament. Nevertheless, the country is rife with political tension. Incumbent President Joseph Kabila, having served two consecutive terms in office, is bound by the Constitution to step down in December. Electoral preparations, including the revision of the electoral register, have yet to begin in earnest. Moreover, President Kabila has indicated that he may not relinquish the presidency when his term ends. In January of last year, his government attempted to change the electoral law to tie elections to the completion of a complex national census. This proposed delay of elections for at least 3 years sparked mass protests. The government has claimed that the only way to get electoral preparation started would be via a national dialogue convened by President Kabila, an idea which the opposition and civil society have roundly rejected as unfair and rigged. In the meantime, authorities have cracked down on those calling for Kabila to step down using intimidation, violence, and arbitrary arrests. Incensed, the political opposition civil society, activists, and students called for a one-day general strike on February 16th to protest these delaying tactics. Just hours prior to the strike, six youth activists from the Fight for Change or LUCA youth movement were arrested for allegedly helping to organize the stoppage. They joined 19 other LUCA members who have been in prison since early 2015. The United States is troubled by the harassment and detention of peaceful activists and opposition leaders in the Democratic Republic of Congo, including those detained in connection with the general strike, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a written statement. These detentions stifle the free expression of diverse political viewpoints, contributing to a closing of political space while undermining the credibility of the government of the DRC during the electoral period. We call on the government to respect the freedoms enshrined in its own constitution, which was promulgated 10 years ago. We also call on the DRC to honor its international human rights obligations and immediately release all those being detained, or short of that, accord them the protections and fair trial guarantees to which they are entitled.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, Ajaja. This one, Ajaja.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all. on VOA Africa.